Who are you, in your own words?
I'm Charlie Clutterbuck. I'm a bit odd in that I've got 3 degrees in agricultural science, including a master's and a doctorate. And these days you can't get this qualification because most of our agricultural colleges and research stations have closed down in the last 25 years, mainly thanks to Mrs. Thatcher saying, let the supermarkets decide rather than having any food and farm policy. So we've had a free market, which is obviously free for the rich, you know, rather than free for the poor. We've had free markets. Lots more food has come into the country. We only produce about a quarter of our own food now, whereas in the late 80s, we produced something like half our food. So, as I say, I started off an academic, but I soon realised that the reason people starve is not because we need to produce more food, it's because they can't afford to buy. That used to be quite hard to explain about the world, while there was nearly a billion people malnourished and starving, to say, well, I can't afford it. I think people now can see it much better with a million people having to go to food banks. You know, nobody's saying we have to produce more food. I mean, it's quite clearly they can't afford to buy what food we've got. So I changed direction, and now I'd like to say I feel that I see the social side and the economic side as much as the ecological side, but I don't want to lose sight of that either.
Okay. A few years ago, you were motivated to write a book which was called Bittersweet Brexit when it appeared, The Future of Food, Farming, Land and Labour. What was the motivation for this work?
It was stimulated primarily about the massive changes which were going to come about because of Brexit. The sad part was not many people were talking about the changes which were liable. And I know that quite a few farmers who voted for Brexit were completely lied to by the ministers at the time. But also quite a lot were fooled that there would be some nirvana, some sunlit uplands, whereas actually it's going to be exactly the opposite. The uplands are going to go to waste or to rich people. So we were looking at a time of change, the like of which we haven't seen in 70 years. And that is now going on. And I'm trying to keep my eyes on what is actually happening, because it isn't just about Brexit. It isn't just about leaving the EU and some of the boring bureaucracy of it. There's a lot more about the free marketeers in the background, you know, wanting to go off around the world to do what we did 150 years ago. And in fact, the civil servants call it Empire 2.0. In other words, it's a new bit of software called Empire Building, and that's going to somehow feed us. And everything I'm picking up is about more free trade deals, more food coming in. We know the standards aren't going to be kept. That's pretty obvious. That is going to put the smaller farmers, particularly, and the small food producers at risk, to put it mildly. I think they're going to be out of business within a year or two. What my big concern is that lots of people aren't that bothered. You know, cheap food, oh, that's a good idea. And those that do know, there's quite a movement to sort of say, oh, well, that means we can have more rewilding. We can have, you know, go have a wilder countryside. It's both the left and the right, if you like, that are sort of quite happy with cheap food coming in. Some say, well, the cheap food, that can help feed the poor. And of course, it won't. It'll just be crap. The issue of the rewilding and the conservation is something I think we have to deal with, that there are many environmentalists think it's quite a good idea what's happening with the changes in farming, that there's going to be a green Brexit. Yet the more I look at it, the more the government has promised the earth, literally promised improved soil, and it can't deliver and is not going to deliver. And just like the health service, behind the scenes, they're all lining up to make a lot of money out of this. And what I can see, and perhaps I don't know if you want me to go into more detail, is that the sort of small farms around here are likely to be taken over by big concerns, big corporations, financial institutions. They'll be bought out for a nominal sum. And so these institutions will have access to larger areas of land, perhaps to build forests, but I think mainly to just make a lot of money, that they're going to control a lot more of the land.
Okay. The title, Bittersweet Brexit, why was that chosen?
Because there were, if you like, there's sweetness and there's bitter. even within the labour movement, you know, there were some people that saw advantages, and there were, the big advantage was clearly doing something with the common agricultural policy. I think just about everybody that knew about it knew it was a silly way of doing business that consists of paying farmers about £100 an acre to do virtually nothing. So the more money you have, the more subsidies you had. So if you paid £100 an acre for having that land, then the more land you have, the more subsidies you got. And I think everybody just thought that was mad. It came out of a very complex situation, though, and that was that after the war, Europe wanted to produce more food. It did not want to be dependent on America ever again. There was something called the Marshall Plan after the Second World War, whereby America dumped lots of grain and rice onto Europe, you know, to help Europe out. But it was very carefully calculated where that food went. And so Europe never wanted to be beholden to America again. So put the money into producing more food. Labour in Britain did the same. The Fabulous Agricultural Act was put money into farmers producing more food. But by the mid-70s, it was obvious they were producing more than enough food. And so in the late 70s, I'm thinking after the Marshall Plan, the Mansholt Plan was the first European plan to try and control food production. And it talked about amalgamating farms. It never worked. We carried on producing more and more food. So you had the horrific contradiction that in the middle of the 80s, you know, people were starving in Ethiopia. Band-Aid and Queen were on stage, you know, screaming for more money to feed the poor in Africa. Meanwhile, we had wine lakes and butter mountains almost in the background behind Wembley Stadium. That was the big contradiction. So again, in the 90s, the attempts were made to try and control the amount of food produced. And this time it's called McSharry Plan. So you have the Marshall, Mansholt and McSharry plans. And McSharry, what he did was to say, well, in future, we're going to put more money into environmental matters rather than just food production matters. That too got a bit complicated. So by the turn of the century, they just said, oh, just pay a flat sum to all landowners, £100 an acre. That worked well in France, Germany, and those countries which have much smaller farms. That made a lot more sense. When it comes to Britain, where the distribution of land is much more unequal here than the rest of the continent, it's something like 6% of the population own about 90-odd percent of the land, then clearly that money just pours into the big landowners. It doesn't get out of their pension funds and out of their pockets. It doesn't trickle down the river, using the trickle-down theory. It actually doesn't come down the river and fertilise the farms on the plains. It doesn't do that at all. It sticks where it is with the landowners. So there's a sense where a lot of us do want to use those subsidies in a different way. So that was the sweet part of it. But the bitter part of it was absolutely obvious that we weren't going to get the free movement of food across the continent anymore. If we come out of the single market, it means the single market was set up to control the standards. And that was another way of controlling overproduction. Because you could only produce food to a certain standard, it meant you couldn't overproduce as much. And you could only do it if you were in that club that's called the single market. So it was patently obvious if you came out of the single market, those standards would go and we wouldn't be allowed back in to overproduce in Europe. So it was quite clear early on, the lamb farmers, the beef farmers were going to suffer. And their voice doesn't get heard, even in the farming community. There is the National Farmers Union, which represents most farmers, basically representing the big farmers, the big ones on the east side of the country, rather than the small family farms on the west side of the country. So that voice didn't get heard. And the ministers, I remember going around promising, oh, don't worry, your subsidies will stay the same, that'll be all right. But clearly they weren't, and they haven't, and that's what I'll come on to later. But that was the bittersweet.
What predictions did you make in the book?
That there'll be a lot more cheap food coming into the country, that would lead to more obesity, that would lead to a loss of livelihoods for smaller producers. I don't know whether they made it in the book, but they made it soon after, that the quota systems would favour companies like Tate and Lyle, who've been big fans of Brexit, And sure enough, the first tariff change that has been made is to allow 250,000 tons of raw cane into the country now with any, without any tax on it. Previously, when we were in the EU, there was a tax on that sugar coming in, which would go to Europe, and they'd just spend that money. But instead of which, the government can and has removed the tariff on that. So instead of us having the tariff, our Treasury having that money, which is what should have happened, it goes basically to Tate & Lyle, who's owned by the American Refining Sugar Company. The tax on that sugar cane, which used to go to Europe, now goes straight to America, and we don't see any of it. So I did predict something like that, that we'll be very short of labour to work the plantations, the farms. Basically, the farms on the eastern side of the country I call plantations, because the definition of a plantation is a monoculture with foreign capital and migrant workers. And we used to think that that was only for bananas and sugar and coffee plantations. But what happened, they've moved that sort of model into the eastern side of the country, so that a lot of foreign capital owns that land. That's almost all monocultures and annual monocultures as well, not perennial. In other words, every year you plant, you know, the strawberries or the fruit. That degrades the land, but the people actually working are predominantly migrant workers, predominantly from the EU. And I predicted coming out of the EU, they wouldn't be coming over here as much. And that actually we'd end up, we wouldn't see many of our British workers going and working at those hours and conditions. So that what would happen is they would pull in migrant workers from outside Europe. And there are already signs of that happening now. So that the only thing which will change is probably the colour of the workforce, not the actual moving over to a British workforce. There's no sign of that happening. You could only do that with a lot of investment, and the government aren't going to do it. So that, I think that was a big prediction I made.
Did you also predict it would be difficult to find increasingly for farmers and food manufacturers in this country to gain access to the European Union's markets?
Well, I should hope so, because that's the difference, if you like, coming out of the single market and coming out of the customs union. That was in debate at that time, if you remember. The Labour Party was saying we wouldn't want to come out of the customs union. We could stay in, right, and come out of Europe. It's a sort of argument, if you like, it appeals to the ones that didn't like Brussels for the bureaucracy and all the ticky-boxy stuff. You'd come out of Europe, out of all that, but you would stay in the customs union. And in a sense, we almost have stayed in, except we haven't. Right at the last minute, we did a trade deal instead of a customs union. So coming out of the customs union means that all the tariffs around the union will change. And we haven't come out to leave them the same. We've come out to get out of those tariffs so we can go off and do other deals. So it was obvious that unless we had some sort of trade deal, then we were going to have to pay taxes on anything going into Europe. So I'm predicting in particular the sheep farms are going to be off to the slaughter, roughly speaking. And I notice even in the Archers at Brookfield Farm, they're talking of getting out of sheep. You know, they're not spelling it out quite how bad it's going to be. But I think what might interest some of your listeners, Mark, is that a lot of people have an idea that all farmers are rich, that they've got big SUVs and they drive around. Clearly, some of them are. But these lamb farmers are not. They're family farms. You're talking about them earning £20,000-£25,000 a year for working every day of the year and most of their family. Out of that, something like £16,000-£18,000 will be in subsidies. The government have already made it clear that's going to halve within 3 years. So you take that £7,000-£8,000 from poorly paid families already, they can't exist. So the government is already offering them money to get out. It's that obvious that that's what they're after. So those farmers, certainly, that was never explained to them. And then after it's cut by half, it's another few years, and it's cut completely. So if you imagine being sat where there's sheep farmers, what else can they do? They can't move the land. What else can they do with that land? So what I'm trying to say is these are poor people that they won't go to the food banks. I know a church organisation around here leaves food in the churches so that the farmers can get access to that food, because they wouldn't be seen going to a food bank. That would be just beyond them. I don't think people realise the poverty in the countryside.
What negative impact did you fear Brexit might have on food and farming? I suppose the quality of food might concern you as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, once we're outside the single market, those standards, some of them are a bit daft, I have to say. But they're, as I say, they were there to protect the farmers. And you could see that as soon as we came out, whatever promises were made, and the Tory manifesto promised to keep the standards, you could see there was no point in coming out if they did. The whole point was to lower the standards so they could do deals with America, Argentina, Australia, and they are trying to do deals with those countries, and those countries are all saying the same thing. You're going to have a beef grown to our standards, the Argentine standards, or the Australian standards, or American. You know, so they're hormone-laden, they're full of antibiotics, the famous chlorinated chickens. You look at the rest of the world, their standards are nowhere near as good as ours. What some people try and say is, oh, well, we'll buy British. Yes, if you're going into Waitrose and you've got the time to wander around and look at the labels, some will buy British, but the manufacturers and the people making packaged meals for M&S and what have you, they're just going to buy the cheapest load they can and stick it in the pre-prepared meals, of which this country, just to emphasise, this country eats more of what's called ultra-processed food. Processed food can be anything with chutneys, you know, with a bit of vinegar and a bit of sugar to preserve them. That's processed food. Ultra-processed food is something, if you like, with more than 6 or 7 ingredients. That's kind of how you tell. In other words, this has been ultra-processed. All the fibre's been taken out. Most of the nutrition's taken out. If there is any nutrition, it's often been put back, like in cornflakes, you know, sit on the label. That's ultra-processed food. And half the food British people eat is ultra-processed food, which is much higher than any other country. Well, I can't see that going down. That's going to get worse rather than better. And so I'm predicting obesity will go up in the next 10 years. And we're already the most obese country in Europe. The only one that competes with us is Malta. It's hardly comparable. I think the women are the fattest in Europe and men are the second fattest, or it might be the other way around. So we are already in a very unhealthy position, and there's no sign of that getting better. No amount of policies. The cheap food will be coming in more. It will go into processed food more. It will be cheap, so more poor people will eat it.
Has the deal that the government's concluded with the EU lessened some of your fears?
No, not at all. The most obvious one was the fisheries. We sort of said in the book that the fisheries were more likely to be hit than they thought they would. But I only saw that in terms of quotas. I remember Johnson going around with a big fish saying, you know, the EU's stolen all our fish. We will put out the line 200 miles round Britain and we will stop them coming in to fish. And I thought, well, that's just impossible. The rights of fishing go back hundreds of years. It's not particularly to do with the EU. My generation remembers the Cod Wars with Iceland. And that came about when we wanted to have the rights to get North Sea oil. We had to claim a 200-mile limit round Britain as ours. So Iceland said, well, if you're claiming 200-mile limit round, then we are claiming 200 miles round Iceland. So you can stop coming into Iceland and fishing our fish. That's how the Cod War started.
What comes next? And that could include whether you think there'll be any possibility of any leadership in a different direction, especially in the current period where the Conservatives and the right of the Conservative Party appear to be in total control of the political situation. Yes, there's complaints about them, but there doesn't seem any effective political opposition to their strand of politics at this moment.
And it actually echoes with what Jenny's saying as well about public and private money together. The big issue at the moment is the matter of subsidies, that we knew there would change and the government announced how they were going to change just at the new year, that half of the subsidies would go within a couple of years and the rest would go within 6 or 7. the big issue was then was how they were going to spend those subsidies monies on greening the land, which they'd promised. That's what they'd promised, that there would be a green landscape and that it would all be environmentally friendly and help for climate change. And all the environmentalists were cheering and clapping. And I thought, no, this is too good to be true. And sure enough, when he started to try and work out where the money was going to be spent for farmers to go green, it was impossible. You couldn't work out where a single penny was going to go. And then they came out and said that 30% of the subsidy money would go to something called a SFI. That is very much like the old system under the EU, which was called countryside stewardship, which was basically for individual farmers to do nice things like build dry stone walls, put a pond in, put verges on the sides of fields. Nothing particular, but that's where a third of the subsidy money was going. So we were all looking at where's the other two-thirds going? And we're just beginning to see what's happening there. It looks as if it's going to be big grants to consortiums, local consortium of interested partners working together. And the idea is they're going to say, well, and there's a bit of it, I agree, you can't bring about environmental change by individual contributions. You know, it only can go so far. At some point, you need a political wherewithal, an organisation to say, well, actually, we want a big scheme here, we want to do that over there, and bring it together so it's not a matter of individual spending. And already, we're just picking up that money is coming in from the government, public money, but it's all to lever in private money. And it's quite clear that he says, you know, public-private financing, that's what they're up to. So that's why I think what's going to happen is, say, round here, an organisation could set up with lots of money, buy out the small farmers and, reforest some of the moors. And a lot of us would be quite happy with that, except, and I remember putting it in a big issue over a year ago, that article I wrote, that doesn't bring in money for people now. It doesn't bring money into the local economy. The trouble with trees is it's 60 or 70 years away before it adds anything to the economy. So it has to be much better thought out than that. But that's the sort of program they're going to build. And it's going to look nice from Westminster. You can, and I noticed Boris Johnson was talking about, oh, beautify the landscape, was his exact words. And he thought, oh, that's lovely, isn't it? You know, but for people living in that landscape, they've had it. So that's the big prediction I'm making. That's where the money is going to go. It's going to link the public money with private money, but you can't help but think the private money is going to get a lot out of this that it couldn't get its hands on before.
What would you like to see happen? You contended in the book that if there's to be subsidies and there's that it should go be spent in certain ways. So what would be your attempt at a solution? Yeah.
In the book, I very clearly spelt out that subsidy money could be much better spent on paying workers decent living wages. And I think we calculated that something like 300,000 people could get an extra £10,000 a year, which would transform pretty paltry existence into a much more decent living. The trouble with that is good argument politically, but technically it's very difficult to see how we could actually deliver that. In the EU, they are trying to do something like that by only giving subsidies to farmers who can prove that they're paying their workers decent wages. Now, that would be quite nice, but we're not going to get anything like that in this country, are we? So the next suggestion I was coming up with was we should pay local authorities so that, say, Preston, just up the road from here, would get something like £20 million. Now, they could then decide where that money was best spent locally to encourage local farmers to produce food for the local communities. So I think that still should be on the table, and I think we should still be making that argument. But the next stage on is that what we really should be using that money for is to give it to poor people already on various benefits. I don't have to go into quite how we decide that. Give them the money in terms of a food card. so that when they go into the market or the local stores, they could use it just like we use loyalty cards. They could use them, and the price of what they're buying would be much lower. If that sounds like a bit bonkers, that idea, it's not. I've stolen it from America. There, most of their subsidies, $50 billion worth, goes to 40 million poor people. So you can soon work that out. That's over £100 a week to a family for them to buy decent local food. They can't buy alcohol with it, and they can't buy McDonald's with it. So the incentive is to buy decent food, and there's an education program around it as to how they can cook decent meals with that money. So that's the way I'm looking at it, that the focus is on poorer people spending money, encouraging them to spend on local food, and that then drives the economy around. So instead of it sat at the top of the hill in the landowners' pockets, it's at the bottom of the hill being spent. And what do people do with that money? They spend it. So it helped the local economy, regenerate the local economies, and help the rural areas around there. I think that idea works particularly well here in the north because, as you know, Mark, there's lots of small towns in the middle of the countryside. It's not like the big metropolises of the world. So, and many of those towns, like Halifax, like I'm thinking of Accrington, Blackburn, Burnley, Bolton, Bury, all of those have not really regained their identity after losing the mills in the early 80s. This would be a way of, you know, what most of those did was just build a retail centre and think that would work. And that doesn't work anymore. People haven't got the money to spend in the retail services to make that work. So this would be a way of not only letting poorer people have access to decent food, but it would be regenerating the economies of those towns. So that's why I'm beginning to call it what Pam Warhurst calls the Northern Greenhouse. So instead of the powerhouse, it's the greenhouse. We use our land around here to produce a lot more food, which we can sell in the local towns to people who need that decent food.
You're planning later this year, if it's safe to do so, to organise a series of walks. What's that all about, please?
I really want people to look out over the land more carefully, more interested. You know, when you're pootling along on a train, you know, most of us just look out the window and the fields go by. I'd love it that people could understand better what is happening and also better what has happened in the past. The land never stays the same. It changes all the time. And by looking at the land, we can see what has happened in the past and how that's changing for the future. Around here in the Forest of Bowland in Lancashire, again, most people think Lancashire is just as the mill towns. There's a lot of countryside around. In the last 5 years, lots of farms have built massive barns. And you think, what is, these are small farms, massive barns, what are they doing? They're moving the cattle indoors for most of the year. And what that means is they'll feed some of it with grass, but it all means that a lot of the food feed, as food for animals is called, a lot of the feed is coming from elsewhere. Maize will be coming across from the other side of the country, but particularly soya will be coming from Brazil to feed the animals. And most of us just think this is utter bonkers. You know, those cattle should be out on the land eating the grass. And by the way, putting their waste back onto the land, regenerating the soil that way, rather than doing it in the big barns where somebody has to come along with a big slurry machine to shovel it all up and then spray it over the land. And believe me, that sort of slurry is not as good as the old-fashioned shit that the cows used to put onto the land. I'm particularly interested in the state of our soils, and that would do a lot to help the soils. But overall, what I want is to be able to show people how things are changing on the land and whether that's good for rural areas or whether it's just good for the people with the money in the cities.
Do you want people to see that there are locations where more food could be grown?
Oh, yes, that would be part of it. Part of the problem is we're sort of concentrating on three or four major crops, wheat, barley, potatoes in this country, maize all over the world. rice all over the world, whereas we should have a much bigger variety of crops. That would not only provide a lot better set of nutrients. The big thing, as an old agricultural scientist I was taught many years ago, was by having a diversity of variation, it's a lot less prone to disease and pests, so you don't need the pesticides and the chemicals. But to do that, we need a different technologies. Most of our technologies come from America, the big machines, rather than small machines. But again, to do that, you'd have to be paying the workers and the labour better wages to make that work. At the moment, we're just driving for cheap food rather than for decent food. And for decent food, we've got to subsidise that in some way. To God, it's much more than the government is talking about with 3 billion. I think we need to 10 times more than that. Wouldn't go amiss, because it would not only be good for the rural areas, it would be good for the NHS. If we have got to cut the amount of obesity in this country, it's too debilitating on the NHS system, as has been shown by COVID. But we've got to address that for the future. I can manage to sort of say point at the land, and you can make connections with the food that people are eating. The land where I used to farm many years ago had been farmed like that for two or three centuries. As I say, now we're changing to this system of having big barns, cattle indoors virtually all the year, and importing the food. It's ridiculous.